Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 265, titled Dracula for President Part 2, Forward into the Past, and this is being recorded on December 17th of the year 2000. The title of the program is a reference to not only the recently concluded and very prolonged American presidential election, but also a reference to a recently concluded election in Romania, in which the runner-up was a right-wing xenophobic individual named Corneliu Tudor, and this fellow was favorably compared by his supporters to not only Vlad Tepes, the prince who was the role model for the Dracula legend, but also the Romanian Iron Guard, the Romanian fascist movement allied with Adolf Hitler, and recently extolled by some elements of the fascist black metal music scene, as well as associated philosophical elements within the conspiracy community. We're going to begin by reviewing an article that will touch off the title reference of the program. This from the Financial Times of Friday, November 24th of the year 2000, an article that we accessed in For the Record program 262, Dracula for President Part 1. That was an update on Eurofascism. This article is by Phelim McAleer, P-H-E-L-I-M, capital M-C, capital A-E-A-L-E-R in Bucharest. It's headlined, Greater Romania Rhetoric Finds a Ready Audience. And this, again, is about Corneliu Vadim Tudor, leader of the Great Romanian Party, an individual who has been attacking Hungarians, Gypsies, and Jews, and invoking a political mantra very reminiscent of the Romanian Iron Guard, as we shall see. One of his supporters compared him favorably to Vlad Tepes, Vlad the Impaler, the role model for the Dracula legend, skipping down in this article. Another supporter, Constanta Avram, 61, who lost her life savings of $3,000 when the country's largest investment fund collapsed during the summer, said Mr. Tudor was following in the footsteps of Vlad the Impaler Tepes, the 15th century Romanian prince who inspired the Dracula legend and who impaled criminals for minor infringements. Quote, we need an iron hand to take us out of the hole we are in. We need a person like Vadim to make order just like Vlad Tepes, unquote, she said. And as I noted in For the Record program 262, the political agenda and the xenophobia cited by Corneliu Tudor is very reminiscent of the Iron Guard, the fascist mystical movement allied with Nazi Germany in World War II, and as we shall see, later incorporated, elements of which were later incorporated, not only into the Western intelligence apparatus, including U.S. intelligence, but also, more importantly, into the Republican Party. The Financial Times of Wednesday, November 29th of the year 2000, had a follow-up article about the candidacy of Corneliu Tudor. This is by Stefan Wagstiel, W-A-G-S-T-Y-L, and Phelim McAleer. And this again from the Financial Times of 11/29/2000. It's headlined, Romanian Right Feeds on Middle-Class Fears. And the article begins, Nicolae Vasice, V-A-S-I-C-E, a Bucharest market trader, has no doubts about why he supports Corneliu Vadim Tudor, the far-right contender for the Romanian presidency. Quote, we need a strong leader that will be good for the country. We need something like the Iron Guard, the 1930s Romanian fascist movement. And that again underscoring a point that I made in For the Record program number 262, which is that basically Tudor was the heir to the Iron Guard heritage. We've discussed the Iron Guard at considerable length in numerous broadcasts in the past, including a miscellaneous archive show M24, For the Record program, programs numbers 29, 113, among others. Also our discussion with Kevin Coogan in For the Record program number 221 and number 222. And also there's discussion of the Iron Guard in Radio Free America program number 2. The Iron Guard, again, were a fascist, mystical movement allied with Nazi Germany in World War II, and as we discussed in For the Record, Radio Free America program number 2, and as we're going to review, the Iron Guard were among those elements that were welcomed in by elements of the Western intelligence apparatus at the end of World War II because of their anti-communist stance and because of their knowledge of activities behind the so-called Iron Curtain, and as we're going to see, we're going to review some aspects of an Iron Guard leader's career both in Romania and in the United States, and we're going to take a look at some of the political heritage of the Republican Party and some of the lessons to be learned in the recently concluded election, and as we will see, one of the things that we have been doing is going forward, advancing into the past. of the Iron Guard and their role in World War II, and specifically of the role played in the Iron Guard and a brutal pogrom against the Jewish population of Bucharest in 1941, we're going to turn to a source that we used in Radio Free America program number 2, recorded in May of 1984. That broadcast, by the way, is entitled Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, Part 2. This is a book entitled Wanted, The Search for Nazis in America. It was authored by Howard Blum. It was published in hardcover by Quadrangle Books. And the ISBN number, I'm going to dig up for you in just a second. And by the way, Quadrangle Books at the time, copyright 1976, was owned by, actually copyright 1977, was owned by New York Times Books. The ISBN number is 0-8129-0607-1. Now, what we're going to do first is to take a look at one of the principal figures in the Iron Guard and a central element in the political heritage laid claim to by Cornelio Tudor, the modern successor to the Iron Guard. By the way, I would note that in the recently concluded Romanian elections, Tudor finished a distant second to a former communist, and that, ladies and gentlemen, is settling for the lesser of two evils. I've recently heard people say, well, you know, I didn't want to vote for Gore because I didn't want to settle for the lesser of two evils. Well, applying the term evil to Al Gore is stretching the term rather far. And you want to know what it's like to settle for the lesser of two evils? Check out what just happened in Romania. And by way of informing ourselves, let's take a look at what happened in Romania in 1941 when Trifa led this particular pogrom, and we're going to take a look at aspects of Trifa's post-war career. By the way, a number of the elements in this particular broadcast will be by way of review for veteran and regular listeners, and other elements will be new. Now, again, the fellow leading this pogrom is VRL Trifa, later, as we shall see, renamed Valerian Trifa, and he was leading this particular pogrom in Bucharest, the capital of Romania, in 1941. And he began by firing up the crowd with the following speech. From the statue of King Michael, VRL Trifa delivered the speech which he and Iron Guard leader Horia Sima had hoped would initiate a new revolt. Trifa, according to eyewitnesses, began cautiously, talking in a steady, calm voice. Below him, the square was packed with 6,000 listeners, and the crowd continued to increase. This war started, Trifa began, with the French Revolution. The origin of the old world was these miraculous words, liberty, equality, and fraternity. These words liberated the people from one tyrant who had enslaved them, and instead, delivered them to hundreds of thousands of tyrants exploiting these principles. People were never equal, Trifa continued, not even in the first days of the revolution. These ideas of equality served a category of people who enslaved others and profited by these confused ideas. These ideas of equality served the caiques. The caiques of Europe have intensified their struggle for emancipation at the moment when the revolutionary spirit reached the Rhine. The leadership of the people has fallen into the hands of a group of caiques and Jew lovers who are ruling everything, especially history. The League of Nations has served the interests of Jewry to dominate the world. London has become the center of world capitalism. On the shores of the fabulous Albion, Jewry has found a good place from where it will spread its spider web over the entire world. By the way, I would note that the Inspector General of the German Armed Forces, Klaus Naumann, in the early 90s, echoed much of this sentiment, saying basically that the job of the reunited Germany and the German army was to roll back the values of the French Revolution, though he did not use the anti-Semitic invective that Trifa uses here. I would also note that considerable elements of right-wing and fascist philosophy in the United States in the year 2000 have their echoes in his rantings here about the League of Nations and not only Jews, but the role of England in this presumed Zionist conspiracy. Continuing now with Trifa's invective. Trifa's voice, now rising, the crowd intermittently shouting and applauding ferociously, he concluded his hour-long speech in a hoarse scream, quote, "Even if Adolf Hitler had done nothing else than wage this huge struggle of National Socialism which leads to the unmasking of the fight against Judaism, he would still have risen to great peaks of history as he blazed a new path," unquote. When the applause subsided, Trifa ordered the crowd to form columns. Then, following the strategy he had formulated with Sima, Trifa led his marchers through the streets of Bucharest. First, the demonstrators marched to the king's palace and then to the Italian and German embassies, where they cheered the assembled foreign ministers. By now, the crowd had swelled, according to witnesses, to nearly 10,000, and as planned, Trifa led the marchers to the steps of General Antonescu's palace. The crowd surged forward, and government troops and tanks started firing. The Iron Guard revolt had begun. By late evening, the revolt had degenerated into a pogrom. Raoul Hilberg, drawing on interviews with eyewitnesses, wrote in The Destruction of the European Jews, quote, "Iron Guardists had stormed into the Jewish quarter, burning down synagogues, demolishing stores, and devastating private apartments. For miles around the city, the Guardists had left traces of their revolution. On January 24th, travelers on the Bucharest-Ploiești road discovered at Banasia over 100 Jewish bodies without clothes." That's Banasia. Continuing, "Gold teeth had been knocked out of the mouths of the dead. On the road to Giurgiu, passers-by stumbled upon another 80 bodies of Jewish slain. In the city itself, the German military attaché was busy collecting casualty reports." Quote, "In the Bucharest morgue," he wrote, "one can see hundreds of corpses, but they are mostly Jews," unquote. Jewish sources report that the victims had not merely been killed, they had been butchered. In the morgue, bodies were observed hanging like carcasses of cattle. A witness saw a girl of 5 hanging by her feet like a calf, her entire body smeared with blood. And, skipping down, "Perhaps the most horrifying single episode of the pogrom was the, quote, kosher butchering, unquote, last Wednesday night of more than 200 Jews in the municipal slaughterhouse." This from a press release about the pogrom. Beginning again, "Perhaps the most horrifying episode of the pogrom was the kosher butchering, unquote, last Wednesday night of more than 200 Jews in the municipal slaughterhouse. The Jews, who had been rounded up after several hours of Iron Guard raids, were put into several trucks and carried off to the slaughterhouse. There, the green shirts forced them to undress and led them to the chopping blocks, where they cut their throats in a horrible parody of the traditional Jewish methods of slaughtering fowl and livestock. Quote, some mangled bodies were disposed of by pouring them down manholes to the sewers usually used to carry animal remains. Other naked, headless bodies were hung on iron hooks and stamped Karne Kosher, kosher meat." Unquote. And that about the pogrom led by Valerian Trifa. What we're going to take a look at next is a bit of history, and this will be by way of review, again, for veteran and regular listeners. And we're going to take a look at how Valerian Trifa and others came to be incorporated not only into American society, but specifically into the U.S. intelligence apparatus, and perhaps even more importantly, through that, ultimately, into the Republican Party of the United States. We're going to take a look at an illegal domestic intelligence operation performed by elements of State Department using CIA funds. This particular operation was entitled The Crusade for Freedom, a misnomer if ever there was one. We discussed this at considerable length in RFA 37. We've also discussed it in Miscellaneous Archive Show M24, For the Record Program 29, 48, and number 113. We're going to reference the material by way of review for veteran listeners from a very important book with a terrible title. The book is entitled The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by John Loftus and Mark Ahrens. John Loftus is a former career military officer and Justice Department investigator with a high security clearance, who not only had power of attorney for a number of veteran intelligence operatives who were permitted to publish their accounts on condition of anonymity, but the book is also, in addition to those sources, the book is lavishly footnoted, some 135 pages of footnotes for a roughly 500-page text. The title is unfortunate because I think, for one thing, people dismiss it, saying, well, I don't want to read about Jews, I don't like Jews. It also, no doubt, will strike some as some sort of grandiose conspiracy theory. The fact of the matter is, the book is about the relationship between the intelligence community, the petroleum industry, and international fascism, and there's never been a single title that has as much of the material that I discuss on this program between its two covers as The Secret War Against the Jews. There are any number of things about the book that I don't agree with, but it is a superb volume. And one of the things that it discusses in considerable length is the Crusade for Freedom. Again, a domestic intelligence operation, altogether illegal, technically CIA, although administered by the State Department, and heavily overlapped with the Republican Party of the United States. The Crusade for Freedom was a program under which Third Reich collaborators, many of them war criminals, some of them even veterans of the Waffen-SS, were brought into the United States and installed as leaders in many of our Eastern European ethnic communities in order to help to deliver the Eastern European ethnic vote to the Republican Party. They were particularly active in the Midwest and Northeast, the so-called Rust Belt, and many of these leaders not only served the Republican Party during election years, but ultimately, as we've seen in numerous past broadcasts, including For the Record program number 248, ultimately this coalesced into a permanent wing of the Republican Party, viewed as being able to deliver the swing vote in five key states in presidential election years. This particular program, which John Loftus also refers to as a fascist freedom fighters program, this particular program was the godchild of Alan Dulles. It utilized Vatican resources, and the person who oversaw this was Richard Nixon, later, of course, President of the United States. Turning to the secret war against the Jews, about the crusade of freedom, for freedom, rather, and Alan Dulles and Richard Nixon's role in same, John Loftus and Mark Ahrens write, with the help of the Dulles-Angleton clique, the Vatican had sent many of the Eastern European Nazis to Western countries, including the United States, Australia, and Canada, where the right wing recruited them to get out the rest of the Eastern European ethnic vote. The man who ran the political recruitment campaign in the United States was Richard Nixon. The cover-up had been going on for a long time before Angleton censored the Vatican files, but the Australians inadvertently had let a tiny corner of the story out of the bag. Although we explore the Republican-Nazi connection in chapters 10 and 13, it is important for the reader to understand the size of the scandal that Angleton Tribe was trying to bury. By the way, that's James Jesus Angleton, former CIA chief of counterintelligence. Continuing. As a young congressman, Nixon had been Alan Dulles' confidant. They both blamed Governor Dewey's razor-thin loss to Truman in the 1948 presidential election on the Jewish vote. When he became Eisenhower's vice president in 1952, Nixon was determined to build his own ethnic base. Note that the razor-thin 1948 presidential election was the genesis for some of this. We're going to take a look at some of the lessons for the even more razor-thin presidential election just concluded. Continuing. Vice President Nixon's secret political war of Nazis against Jews in American politics was never investigated at the time. The foreign language-speaking Croatians and other fascist emigre groups had a ready-made network for contacting and mobilizing the Eastern European ethnic bloc. There is a very high correlation between CIA domestic subsidies to fascist freedom fighters during the 1950s and the leadership of the Republican Party's ethnic campaign groups. The motive for the under-the-table financing was clear. Nixon used Nazis to offset the Jewish vote for the Democrats. In 1952, Nixon had formed an ethnic division within the Republican National Committee. Quote, displaced fascists, hoping to be returned to power by an Eisenhower-Nixon liberation policy, signed on with the committee. In 1953, when Republicans were in office, the immigration laws were changed to admit Nazis, even members of the SS. They flooded into the country. Nixon himself oversaw the new immigration program. Recall, as we've looked at in, among other programs, For the Records 186 and 248, dealing with some of the political heritage of George W., George Herbert Walker Bush was a close political ally of Alan Dulles and also very, very close to Richard Nixon, perhaps even closer to Richard Nixon. And Richard Nixon was a protege of Alan Dulles, Dulles very close to George W.'s grandfather, Prescott Bush Sr. It should be noted that as we looked at in For the Record program number 249, the Free Europe Committee, which was the State Department front for importing many of these Nazis into the United States, again, for political purposes, for specifically the purpose of affecting American elections, the two of George Bush's Skull and Bones classmates had been members of the Free Europe Committee. It was the Free Europe Committee, which was the umbrella organization under which the Crusade for Freedom was accomplished. Turning to a footnote in The Secret War Against the Jews, more about the personnel involved along with Alan Dulles and Richard Nixon in the Crusade for Freedom. The Free Europe Committee was firmly under the control of the Dulles Brothers State Department clique. When Alan Dulles became head of the CIA, he brought Radio Free Europe into the organization and pretended to do a little house cleaning. A 1953 CIA investigation resulted in the firing of several of the more notorious Nazis on the committee, but most of them stayed on the payroll or switch to different organizations. Bill Casey, who later became CIA director and played a key role in the Iran-Contra affair, had worked in Germany on the Nazi Freedom Fighters program. Bill Casey, of course, was later the campaign manager for Ronald Reagan and George Bush's 1980 presidential run, and then, of course, he was installed as CIA director by Reagan. The role of William Casey in this as follows. Bill Casey, who later became CIA director and played a key role in the Iran-Contra affair, had worked in Germany on the Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, he headed up the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of fascist freedom fighters to the United States. The frontman for Crusade for Freedom, the money-laundering organization for Radio Liberty, was a young movie actor by the name of Ronald Reagan. Dulles could certainly spot talent. So again, note that Ronald Reagan was the chief spokesperson for this operation. Bill Casey handled many of the State Department machinations that were involved. And once again, note that two of George Herbert Walker Bush's Skull and Bones classmates were enlisted by Dulles in this particular committee. Reviewing from For the Record Program 249, the Skull and Bones Club was one of the principal recruiting sources for Dulles's Office of Policy Coordination and later the CIA. Two of the 13 members of George Bush's Skull and Bones class joined Dulles's intelligence fronts. According to extensive research by Peggy Raboam, one of George Bush's Skull and Bones classmates was Howard Weber, the European desk chief for the Free Europe press offices in Munich, Germany, which praised Dulles's freedom fighters, unquote. Weber's boss was another of Bush's Skull and Bones classmates, Samuel Sloan Walker, Jr. From 1951 to 1959, Walker was the director of the Free Europe Press as well as vice president of the parent body, the Free Europe Committee. The Free Europe Committee, better known as Radio Free Europe, was the principal financial conduit for laundering money to Dulles's Nazi proteges. It was exposed as an intelligence front by the U.S. Senate in 1971. And as we looked at in For the Record Program number 248, and as we're about to review right now, the individual who was the chairman of the Republican National Committee when this Nazi emigre group was formally incorporated as a wing of the Republican Party in 1972 was George Herbert Walker Bush, the Nixon ally who had been appointed by Nixon as head of the Republican National Committee. Reviewing now from The Secret War Against the Jews. So in 1972, Nixon appointed George Bush as head of the Republican National Committee. It was Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic emigre a permanent part of Republican politics. In 1972, Nixon's State Department spokesman confirmed to his Australian counterpart that the ethnic groups were very useful to get out the vote in several key states. Bush's tenure as head of the Republican National Committee exactly coincided with Laszlo Pastor's 1972 drive to transform the Heritage Groups Council into the party's official ethnic arm. The groups Pastor chose as Bush's campaign allies were the emigre fascists whom Dulles had brought to the United States. It seems clear that George Bush, as head of the Republican National Committee in 1972, must have known who these ethnics, unquote, really were. Columns by Jack Anderson and others had already made it clear in 1971 that Nixon was a little too close to the fascist groups. The Nazis for Nixon problem was one of those scandals that Bush inherited when he took over the Republican National Committee. And it should be noted that later these same Nazis turned up on George Bush's 1988 campaign, as we looked at in Miscellaneous Archive Show M24. That campaign was managed for George Herbert Walker Bush by George W., currently the president-elect of the United States. Now, as I mentioned, among the elements that were incorporated as part of the crusade, incorporated into American society as part of the Crusade for Freedom, and one of the elements that ultimately helped to became a conduit for the Republican Party was an SS intelligence unit named Vorkommandow Moscow. This was literally an entire SS intelligence unit composed of anti-communist Russians that was brought complete and intact into the United States at the end of World War II. Among the activities that were overseen by this SS intelligence unit, the Vorkommandow Moscow, was the liquidation of much of the Jewish population of the occupied former Soviet Union. of the Vorkomanda Moscow and its incorporation into American society, courtesy of the Crusade for Freedom and Messrs. Dulles, Nixon, Reagan, and Casey, and later some of its elements incorporated into the Republican Party, courtesy of George Bush, we read as follows in The Secret War Against the Jews. Vorkomanda Moscow was an elite forward unit of SS intelligence on the Soviet front. Its primary mission was anti-communist intelligence collection, but it also was responsible for security screening of the occupied populations in a broad sector of the Eastern Front, which held nearly 6 million Jews. Precisely this security and intelligence experience made the men of the unit so attractive to Western intelligence after the war, and led them to their journey to the United States and membership in Nixon's Republican ethnic groups, unquote. Vorkomanda Moscow did not kill the Jews. It hired the collaborators who recruited the executioners, who in turn killed the Jews. From 1940 to 1942, this one small unit acted as an employment agency for the architects of Nazi genocide in Eastern Europe. Contrary to popular belief, while the Germans masterminded and controlled the machinery of the Holocaust, the foot soldiers who carried it out were not primarily Germans, but local volunteers from Poland, the Baltic States, Ukraine, and White Russia. Those non-Germans who wished to serve Hitler's new order first had to pass a security check by Vorkomanda Moscow. And again, this is by way of review for veteran listeners to the program. What we're going to do in the second half of the program is we're going to take a look at what became of Valerian Trifa in his post-war activities. We're going to take a look at his installment as head of the Romanian American Orthodox Episcopate, how he came to be head of that particular religious group, and we're going to take a look at his role giving the opening prayer before the United States Senate in 1955, invited there by none other than Richard Nixon. And in turn, we're going to draw some lessons from some of the activities of Messrs. Trifa et al. For the recently concluded presidential election here in the year 2000. However, we're going to be going into this in the second side of the program. The various programs that I've recorded over the years are available from a tape duplication service called Spitfire. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E. They're located at P.O. Box 1179. That's P.O. Box 1179. That's in Ben Lomond, California, capital B-E-N, capital L-O-M-O-N-D, zip code 95005. The email address for Spitfire is mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. And there are lists of and descriptions of the various tapes available from Spitfire. First of all, on the Real Audio-equipped Spitfire website at spitfirelist.com. That's one word, S-P-I-T-F-I-R-E-L-I-S-T. com, and also on the KFJC website at kfjc.org. Look in the Transmissions and Public Affairs section. A station on the East Coast, specifically WFMU-FM in East Orange, New Jersey, has now begun archiving some of the For the Record programs on Real Audio. So people who are online, in addition to hearing the weekly show that I do on KFJC, my home base station, from 7 to 10 p.m. Pacific time, and in addition to accessing the pair of half-hour segments that Spitfire is sending out to the stations who carry this program, people can now access, courtesy of the World Wide Web, Real Audio archives that are being put together by WFMU. You can access these Real Audio archives at wfmu.org/Dave Emory, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. Alternate address is wfmu.org/playlists/DX. But again, for simplicity's sake, wfmu.org/Dave Emory, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. People can email me at kfjc at D-E-M-O-R-Y at kfjc.org. That concludes Side 1 of Dracula for President, Part 2, Forward into the Past. This is being recorded on December 17th of the year 2000. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.